Thanks very much indeed, Petrok. Yes, tonight at the Proms, we've the last of this season's visits by a youth orchestra. The Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester are here with conductor Herbert Blomstedt, and a programme exploring their own rich musical heritage. We've Mahler's orchestral song cycle, the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, Songs of a Wayfarer, sung tonight by the German baritone Christian Gerheyer. After the interval, Bruckner's monumental unfinished Last Symphony, the Ninth, his attempt to forge a lasting musical legacy. To open, with music written by Hindemith in 1934, his symphony Matthias de Mahler. He also wrote an opera of the same name, based on the story of the German Renaissance painter Matthias Grünewald, a people's hero fighting a repressive regime. For an audience in 1930s Germany, the message was clear. Certainly it was to the Nazi authorities, and in the end, Hindemith was forced into exile. Ultimately, his reputation, like so many other composers of that time, was tainted by the sweeping political and social fallout of the Nazi regime. But for tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt, Hindemith remains one of the cornerstones of German music.
Well, historically, he is an enormously important person for the development of German music. Hindemith went back to the sources, to Renaissance music, to Baroque music, and got new ideas from there, and it was very refreshing. And I remember when I came to Darmstadt to study new music after the war, Hindemith was the big name. But very soon he was forgotten, and other big names came in, John Cage and Boulez and so on. So Hindemith had a very tragic history to his music. The music itself is great, and this symphony is one of the peaks.
Tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt. Well, as we just heard, Hindemith definitely no favourite with the authorities, and the symphony we're about to hear only got its first performance in Berlin in 1934 because of the insistence of one man, the conductor Wilhelm Furtwängler. The opera itself wasn't heard until 1938 in Zurich, so well after Hindemith had left Germany. I'm walking out now onto the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall. Herbert Blomstedt to join the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra in Hindemith's Matthias de Mahler.
Thank you. Thank you.
Paul Hindemith's vivid characterisation of the man he called the embodiment of problems, wishes, doubts, which have occupied the minds of all serious artists from remotest times. Hindemith's symphony, Matthias der Maler, Matthias the Painter, a celebration of one of Germany's greatest painters, Matthias Grunewald. Was performed here at the Proms by the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, conducted by Herbert Blomstedt. Leading the orchestra this evening, Shira Epstein. As we said earlier, Hindemith was a composer obsessed by what he called the ethical imperatives of music, the moral obligations of a musician. And once the Nazis came to power in Germany in 1933, those concerns, of course, became more pressing for him than ever. He was determined to use music as a means of commenting on the wider issues of society. And that score, like so much of his music, really intricate, really complex, played with utter clarity and beauty by this very young orchestra. All the players, 26 years and under. Now, next on the bill this evening, music by this orchestra's namesake, the great song symphonist, as he's often known, Gustav Mahler, his cycle, Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, the songs of a wayfarer. A four-movement cycle, it was inspired by Mahler's deeply unhappy love affair with a soprano, Johanna Richter. He met her while he was conductor of the opera house in Kassel in Germany. The songs are the usual stuff. There's love, rejection, longing, desolation. It's a typically Mahlerian mix here of rapture tempered by desolation. There's even rage and fury. The lyrics are by the composer himself, but there's echoes here of Des Knaben Wunderhorn, that collection of German folk poetry that was, throughout his life, one of Mahler's favourite books. The first song of these four is based on a Wunderhorn poem, Wann mein Schatz. There are strong connections between this work and Mahler's first symphony. The theme of the second song here is exactly the same as that of the symphony's first movement. The final verse of the fourth song reappears in the first symphony's funeral march. Well, you'll be able to do a little compare and contrast for yourself in a couple of days' time. Simon Rattle and the Berliner Philharmonica are here at the Proms on Friday night when they'll be performing Mahler 1 along with Beethoven's fourth symphony. Anyway, back to this song cycle, originally written for voice and piano, although it was always intended as an orchestral song cycle. The orchestrations were finished at a later date than the piano version. Tonight's soloist certainly knows this work well. He's the baritone Christian Gerheyer. Earlier this year, he and the pianist Gerald Huber released their new recording of the four Wayfarer songs. That was to rave reviews. Well, earlier today, I met up with Christian Gerheyer. I began by asking him how he mentally and emotionally prepared himself for a performance of Mahler's tragic cycle.
I try not to identify with any person with which I'm dealing on stage. So I'm not absolutely distant from the content of the music I'm performing or from a role that I'm performing on stage. But I try not to bring out my personal emotions and my personal history. I have the feeling that I'm also a listener, also part of the audience when I'm on stage. And actually I am, because much more music is done apart from me. I am not able, and I don't want to be able, apart from that, to absolutely plan what is happening. That means I'm also not able to judge about a performance afterwards. I have one feeling, one part of the audience has this feeling and that. The truth is somewhere else in the ceiling, maybe.
The truth is somewhere else in the ceiling tonight. Soloist Christian Gerheyer on that mystical space between what the performer feels and how the audience responds to a performance. So, Mahler's four songs that Christian Gerheyer is about to perform. We start with Wenn mein Schatz Hochzeit macht, when my love becomes a bride. Then, ging heut morgen übers Feld, as I walked this morning through the field. Ich hab ein glühend Messer, I have a gleaming knife. And finally, die zwei blauen Augen, my love's two eyes of blue. Well, you can get more information on the texts of these songs, the background to the cycle, indeed all of the works in tonight's concert. You just need to log on to our website. It's bbc.co.uk/proms, where you'll find full programme notes and song texts that you can download. So applause now for tonight's soloist, Christian Gerhaer, joining Herbert Blomstedt and the players of the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra for Mahler's Songs of a Wayfarer.
das Feld, Paula auf den Gräsern hin, sprach zu mir der Lustgefink, ei du Geld. Guten Morgen, ei Geld, du wirst nicht eine schöne Welt, schöne Welt. Geschält, wird nicht eine schöne Welt, schöne Welt. Kling, 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 schönes Ding, wie mir doch die Welt gefällt. Heia! Zu funkeln auf. Alles, alles tun und Farbe gewann im Sonnenschein, Blum und Vogel groß und klein. Guten Tag, guten Tag. Ist nicht eine schöne Welt, ein Vogel, schöne Welt. Nun fängt auch mein Glück wohl an. Ein Messer in meiner Brust. Oh wie, das schneit so tief. In jede Freude und jede Lust. So tief, es schneit so weh und tief. Ach, was ist das für ein böser Gast? Ach, was ist das für ein böser Gast? Nimmer hält er Ruhe, nimmer hält er Rast. blaue Augen schien.
I knew no more of life's travail, all was well again. Love and sorrow, the world and dreams. Mahler's tragic lover walks out into the night to find peace in death under the linden tree. The baritone Christian Gerheyer with a performance of Mahler's Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, Songs of a Wayfarer, was conducted by Herbert Blomstedt with the Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester. Their leader here tonight, Shira Epstein. Christian Gerheyer told me earlier that he sees this cycle, he said, as a wonder. Where a Schubert cycle will be 20, 24 songs, Mahler here creates a whole world in just four songs. They don't have the narrative range, he says, of Schubert, but they more than make up for it in emotional power. And a performance of immense concentration, stillness, and extreme emotional power from Christian Gerheyer. He's very contained as a performer, very contained as a person. And he lets these songs absolutely speak for themselves. Very warm holding of hands between him and tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt. Yet again, it's worth saying that is another challenging score. Huge amount of different colours, moods to evoke in it. And exquisitely done by this orchestra, I thought. Very different kind of performance required for a singer, not to just have the dynamic of a pianist there, but to have 70 odd players to get in sync with. And they managed it quite beautifully here. So we've reached the interval now in tonight's promise. Still to come this evening, a performance of Bruckner's Final Symphony, the Ninth. Before that, we've another talk in our proms series called My Summer Job. The novelist, Tim Pears, remembers how he tried to earn a living in 1978.
I left school at 16, hung around at home, more or less a layabout. I'd had a long stretch in hospital. My parents' marriage had broken up. And I was a pretty typical adolescent. On the one hand, mesmerised by poetry, or more particularly, the idea of being a poet. On the other hand, indolent, shy, depressed, feeling worthless, alienated from those around. Home was a Devon village on the eastern edge of Dartmoor. It was the mid-1970s. I had inconclusive efforts at employment, signed on the dole, read with a brain like blotting paper. I scribbled confessional poetry, though there was nothing to confess, but read, mostly fiction, the 19th century canon of Russian novels in my father's study, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Turgenev. My school contemporaries sat their A-levels and went to university, hopefully to ameliorate what remained of their adolescent neurosis in sex and song, study and student politics. I was meanwhile ordered to seek counsel from the local careers advice centre in Exeter, and after probing interviews and extensive questionnaires, I was told that I was best qualified, by ability and temperament, for a job in the careers advice service. Realising how stuck in a rut I was, I finally left home, but only to retreat further from the front line of life, to a tiny cottage in the Welsh hill borders. The poetic vocation, it seemed, to be a lonely one. Actually, my grandparents lived higher up the valley. My grandfather had been a bishop in the Church of England, robed in purple vestments, which was a mystery, since it was hard to imagine a man of less pretension or ambition. Now he potted in the garden, his social life consisting of interruptions from passers-by, with whom he filled his pipe and shared gossip and jokes. He typed long letters to his grandchildren, filled with scurrilous fictions about Margaret Thatcher, the milk snatcher, well-known Satanist Keith Joseph, and Chingford bother boy Norman Tebbit, people I, with little interest in the wider world, was barely aware of. One of his sidelines in retirement was to sweep the chimneys of his friends' houses, and in this I became his apprentice. We drove in his blue Renault to bungalows nestled in the hills. Although I was politically apathetic, it amused him to describe me as his communist grandson, as I spread the white sheets and connected the rods, screwing one to another, pushing the lengthening pole up the chimney. Back at their cottage, Grandma prepared a lunch of soup and ploughman's, and Grandad would chuckle as he recounted the startled look on the faces of their friends, who had feared for a moment that this shy revolutionary might bring the black soot down the chimney and spread it all over their bourgeois furniture and fitted carpets. I needed paid work, and found it at Mellington Hall, a dark, imposing Victorian manor, a 5-mile cycle ride across the Camlad Valley. It was a hotel once resided in by leisured upper-class tourists who came to cruise the empty roads of mid-Wales, indulge in a spot of pheasant shooting in the woods around Clun, or trout fishing in the River Vernwy. Recently, however, the urban working classes of the Midlands had accrued cash, and Mellington Hall had plunged down market to cater for those with a small amount. The 200 acres of its tranquil parkland filled with mobile homes squeezed into plots between the rhododendrons. I became the groundsman. The owner was a big, ill-tempered man called Pugh. He explained that my job was to cut the grass and just look after everything, whatever that meant. He showed me the tool shed and gave me the keys to a Land Rover and stumped back to the hall. At first, I'd finish a task and drive up to the hall to seek out Mr. Pugh and ask him what he wanted doing next. A grimace of put-upon irritation infused his peevish, bewhiskered countenance, and he strode outside to show me the Spartan toilet blocks that required scrubbing or a ditch to be unblocked. Gradually, I cottoned on that all he really wanted was to be left alone. So I scythed long grass, fly-mowed slopes. The terraced lawns around the hall I cut with a tennis court roller mower in straight lines up and down like a soldier on parade. I spent the summer happily roaming the grounds, clearing undergrowth, chopping wood. Mr. Pugh sought me out only when a mobile home arrived that needed squeezing into a new pitch. We'd hitch it to the Land Rover, and he'd drive with remarkable, gruff dexterity, muttering and cursing as he reversed the long, unwieldy trailer into its snug slot. The Brummies who owned these static caravans I rarely saw, even when parked cars indicated their residence. The odd child could be seen mooching about, but the adults were asleep inside, the reward for their labours a country holiday of complete inertia. Occasionally a man would step out of his trailer, take in the view, stretch and yawn and go back in. At the weekend, they traipsed over to the bar in the hall, where, an occasional barman, I served them beer or baby sham. The place smelled of aerosol air freshener and brute aftershave. Mrs. Pugh provided scampi and chips and chicken in the basket, after which the women played bingo while their children danced to the Bee Gees and Donna Summer in the ballroom, multicoloured disco lights splashing around the mullion windows and wooden panelling on the walls. In the autumn, I was joined in the cottage by a Devon friend, Mark, a fellow aspiring writer. He'd got a proper job in publishing, but now he gave it up to see if he could write the books instead. He scrawled fragments of overwrought, psychologically intense narrative featuring characters tortured by existential angst. I continued to write solipsistic poems that seemed to be getting longer and more complicated, though no better. I didn't realise, but I was trying to make them into short stories. With the onset of winter, Mellington Hall needed less upkeep and my hours were cut, but I was given some more work by Peter Stainer, a Liverpudlian engineer who'd worked in Saudi Arabia. He had bought a derelict ruin up beyond my grandparents' cottage, in a ravine between Corndon and Rantin Hills. Peter, his wife Carol, and two children lived in a caravan in the garden while he built them a home from the rubble. A tall, rangy man of energy and enterprise, Peter approached each stage of house building as a problem to be solved and a new skill to be learned. He hired me when he needed an extra hand. I mixed the cement for the bricks he laid, and we cut and raised the beams for the first floor. Mark went back to Devon for the Christmas holidays. Christmas Day itself of 1978 was mild. I walked in shirt sleeves up to my grandparents, who fed me and let me spend the afternoon with them. We played Scrabble, and in the evening, despite Morecambe and Wise's defection from BBC to ITV, watched the Eric and Ernie Christmas show. Harold Wilson, the recently resigned Prime Minister, appeared in a sketch. He upset Eric Morecambe, who went off in a huff and reappeared with a banner that declared, "Maggie rules, OK?" I reeled merrily home in a pitch-black night, moon and stars obscured by a thick blanket of cloud. The footpath crossed a field in which a large, heavy black bull resided, but I passed him 100 times in daylight, and he had never taken any notice of me, saving his energy, presumably, for the duties that had kept him from the abattoir. That Christmas Day night, I headed back to my dark cottage with no thought of the bull or anything else. But suddenly, in the middle of that field, in the utter darkness, something made me stop stock still. I stood unmoving, heart stopped, senses alert, terrified, though I knew not of what. And then I realised, from a combination of the sound of his muscular breathing and his body heat, that the black beast was right there, inches in front of me. I took a step back and made a slow, wide arc around him. The weather changed. With the new year came blizzards of ice and drifting snow. It was the winter of 1979, one of the coldest of the 20th century. It would also become the so-called winter of discontent, a season of rowdy industrial unrest, of which I first became aware when the school in the local village closed, first when the teachers went on strike, then again when it ran out of heating oil. Gangs of happy children built snowmen by the main road, tobogganed down the hillsides. Mark and I heated our cottage with fallen branches we dragged in from an ever-widening radius, and cut with a long two-handled saw. Each pulled and let go, pulled and let go, the saw singing back and forth. Perspiring with the exertion, we removed jackets, pullovers. Those woodcutting sessions were about the only times we got really warm that winter. We lived on homemade soda bread and vegetable soup, porridge and apples, coffee and cigarettes. We put a small table on either side of the front room and wrote back to back, facing the wall, dressed in thick clothes. Shivering pen in fingerless gloves, green wood smoking in the grate. We shared one old Olivetti typewriter Grandad had given me and sent our work off in a weekly ritual at the post office down in the village, to now long defunct magazines like Bananas and New Hope. Mark's rejection letters invited him to send in more of his intriguing stories. No one asked to see more of my poems. As darkness fell, we sometimes ploughed through the snow to spend long evenings with a lovely woman who lived with her aunt in a wooden house down the hill. The four of us played cards and did crosswords. When power cuts occurred, we lit candles and sipped slow gin. Late at night, Mark and I stumbled back across the fields to our cottage. Through January and into February, the weather was miserable, with recurring heavy snowfalls and severe frosts, while around the country, industrial action was escalating. Trains stopped running, airports shut down. ambulance drivers and even nurses went on strike. Through knee-high snowdrifts, my bicycle redundant, I trudged the 5 miles to work at Mannington Hall. None of the Brummies came to stay in their trailers. "All too busy bloody striking," said Mr. Pugh, and with no petrol for the Land Rover, he laid me off for good. In our cottage, Mark and I used our rejection letters as wallpaper insulation, covering cracks where the frozen wind blew in. Amongst the books Mark had brought with him to Wales were And Quiet Flows the Don and The Don Flows Home to the Sea, Mikhail Sholokhov's epic novels of Cossack tribes during the Russian Revolution and Civil War. The wind came clear across from the Urals, and we seemed in Britain to be inhabiting a Russian winter of our own. Mark and I had cut ourselves off from the world in order to write, before we had anything to write about. But I followed political events from our border exile with increasing interest, beginning to realise that one's own story was part of a much bigger one. With no sign of a snowplough to clear the roads, I carried a rucksack full of food to my grandparents up the hill. Grandad said he'd decided to give up chimney sweeping for his friends. "The trouble is, you see," he told me, "we're doing some poor fellow out of a job." In late January, grave diggers in Liverpool and Tameside had gone on strike for better wages. Coffins now piled up, and Liverpool City Council requisitioned an empty factory to store them. A journalist asked the medical officer for health of Liverpool what would happen if the strike continued, and the officer confided that burials at sea were being considered. I wasn't looking for an increase in my own casual pay, but as the dreadful weather continued, I did begin to see the benefits of an office job. The walls of Peter's house had risen, the ceiling joists were in place, and it was time to raise the roof. We put the rafters up to the ridge beam, attached braces, trusses and purlins, often working as snow fell so that we'd lose sight of one another and call out, our voices muffled. The day we put the roofing felt on, there were gusty winds swirling around the hill. We began across the bottom of the roof at the eaves, pinning the end of a heavy roll of black felt to a rafter at one edge and then unrolling the rest across the roof, tacking it down as we went. When we reached the far end, I'd cut off the remainder of the roll, and while Peter went back knocking in wooden battens to secure the felt in place, I'd move on up to begin the next one. Blustery weather is not the best in which to work on a roof. We had to crouch close to the surface to stop the wind blowing us off, which made hammering the nails in somewhat awkward. But Peter had a schedule he wanted to keep to. We finished one side of the roof at noon, ate our sandwiches in a hurry, and began the other side. Late in the afternoon, as the light began to fade, I unrolled our last line of felt, tacking it as I went. Peter had climbed down to get some more battens. I reached the far end of the roof, cut the remnant of the roll, and let it drop to the ground far below. All of a sudden, a gust of air came howling up the ravine towards us. It shuddered into the shell of the house, which, with this last line of felt, I had just sealed. Seeking escape, the wind flew up through the building and whipped loose the far end of the roll of felt I'd just tacked down. I watched, horrified, as the felt ripped through the few nails holding it down, rising like some predatory, unfurling tongue towards me. By the time it reached me, the weight of the felt and the speed at which it was moving were going to take me with it off the highest part of the roof. I let go of the tools I was carrying and slid down over the battens below me, just far enough to hear the felt flap past my head and then watch it blow high into the air and ripple off across the sky like a black prehistoric creature. Through February, there were further blizzards and snowdrifts, black ice on ungritted roads. Towns and cities in the eastern counties of England were entirely cut off. Roads were strewn with abandoned cars. On the house-building front, Peter chose the very coldest day of the winter to start glazing the windows. Sheets of glass were delivered, from which he cut each small pane we needed, breath condensing in the air as he mumbled the measurements to himself. It was my job to install the panes, pinning each one in place before securing it with putty. It was too delicate a job to wear gloves, but that frozen day my fingers soon grew numb and became unwieldy. They wouldn't do what they were meant to. The glass panes began to be smeared with blood from cuts I couldn't feel. At some point I noticed a sound which I realised was coming from my own lips, whimpering like a dog from the cold. Peter sent me home, disappointed. The shelves in the village shop emptied as people stocked up on canned food. Waste collection workers went on strike and rubbish piled up outside people's houses. In London, Westminster Council allocated rubbish to be dumped in Leicester Square. The great mounds of it there became infested with rats. The country was freezing and paralysed, but beneath the surface, great change was coming. In our own world, repressed forces stirred. Mark and I and a mutual friend we'd spent our winter evenings with found ourselves entangled in a triangle of unrequited affections. At least two of us had fallen deeply for the wrong person. It all came out as the snow thawed and water began to flow down the hillsides in torrents and gullies. We couldn't carry on. Mark returned to Devon. Within a year, had a serious job, a wife, a child. I soon followed him off the hill and made my way to Oxford, where I would work for the next 10 years as a building labourer and in other manual work while I learned how to write prose, novels engaging with the society we live in. I got to Oxford just in time to vote there in the general election of 1979. The national mood seemed to have equated the winter of industrial unrest with the treacherous weather, as if each had conspired with the other to spread misery across the country. In May, Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party rode to power to save the wealthy from left-wing madness and to wreak its own brand of havoc. I remember those days of my immature exile when I sweep a chimney or clear a drain with a set of rods I would inherit from my grandfather, who teased me into opening my eyes.
That interval talk was presented by Tim Pears and produced in Bristol by Tim D. And a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall, where tonight the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra are visiting with conductor Herbert Blomstedt. Just a single work left on the programme here tonight. It's Bruckner's very last piece, his Ninth Symphony. It was a work that struggled to come into being, written at the height of Bruckner's powers. He spent 9 years trying to complete this, the final masterpiece, his last word on symphonic music. But the composer died before he could finish the task. Well, Bruckner was a man whose convictions and beliefs were made concrete in his music. His symphonies, often called cathedrals in sound, are monumental statements of personal expression. He was a composer on the edge of the cultural elite. He was appalled at musical trends and fashions, taking little interest in the world beyond music theory. His work steered clear of outside influences. He was a bachelor with a crippling inability with the opposite sex. There were a few rather sad attempts to propose marriage to various girls. He often fell deeply, if unrequitedly, in love. Bruckner's peasant roots, his strict upbringing, his career as a teacher, his failure in love, all of them left their mark on his work. This was a man with the deepest respect for authority, for tradition. He was deferential with an utter dread of any criticism. His scores were impeccably neat, his corrections precise, his ideas explored with patience and unfailing logic. For Bruckner, there was no room at all for cheap sentiment or sensuous passion. But despite that reputation as a conservative, for tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt, Bruckner is the very opposite. In effect, he's almost a proto-modernist.
Bruckner is supposed to be a very simple man, that very old-fashioned. In a way, that's also true, but he was a very keen mind. And he was an absolutely honest composer. Every bar is truth, so to speak. He is nothing that is fake. The musical texture and the musical melodies and harmonies have their own laws, and when they lead him into extreme dissonances, he is going that direction. At the climax of the third movement, which is the climax of the whole symphony, it ends with a chord which is so dissonant that you don't believe, and it is painful even for the ear. It's even physically painful, like a scream. You cannot say anything. And only after several seconds you can resume, and in a most moving way, Bruckner bids farewell. He was a sick man. He knew he could not complete the finale. And he looks back at some earlier works. It's a moving farewell. The violin satitim, pom, 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 bim, pom, like waving goodbye him. It makes a very gripping experience for everyone who plays it and everyone who listens.
Given that the work is so complex, so large, how do you take these very young players to the heart of that? What words do you give them to take them into the heart of Bruckner's music?
I don't lecture them. I think lecture does not help very much. I remember rehearsing this symphony with my orchestra in San Francisco, and one of the very best musicians in the orchestra came to me in the first intermission at the rehearsal and said, "Maestro, what's this music really about?" I couldn't answer her. I told her, "Come back after the performance." She did not come back. She didn't need to. She had got it. You have just to open your ears and use your own intelligence, use your own imagination, open your heart, and the music will speak.
Tonight's conductor, utterly charming and eloquent, Herbert Blomstedt. I was talking to him earlier today. A large piece for which large orchestral forces are required. There's around 114, 115 players on stage. I can't say that I've counted them for you accurately, but that's my best guess, including 12 double basses. They're banked along the back of the platform, along a riser right at the top, spreading right across the back of the orchestra. Kind of musical backbone, if you like, there to underpin the orchestra with those massive, slow-moving, deep bass harmonies that characterise so much of Bruckner's music. So now, joining the players of the Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester, it's tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt, to conduct Bruckner's mighty Ninth Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
and Tom Bruckner's unfinished Ninth Symphony. A performance here at the 2010 BBC Proms by the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, conducted by Herbert Blomstedt. The orchestra led by the Israeli-British young violinist Shira Epstein. That symphony was a work that its composer never got to hear. Bruckner died in 1896. The first performance of this symphony took place 7 years after that. And just a superb performance by this orchestra. Founded a quarter of a century ago by Claudio Abbado, the first youth orchestra to recruit from both Eastern and Western Europe, Abbado is still their music director. Every year he presides over a panel of judges, 1,500 applications from across Europe to join this band. Really means something to be part of this elite group. And no mean feat to conduct tonight's programme. It's a heck of a thing to perform, but tonight's conductor, Herbert Blomstedt, is in his 80s and just beams at the orchestra. A passionate communicator, wants to bring every last drop of expressive power out of these young players. And a fantastic atmosphere here between all of them in rehearsals. Well, something tells me they're going to get pretty good reviews for this in the papers tomorrow. But these players will not be here to read them. The orchestra's off back to Germany to perform the same programme again. They'll be playing on Friday. That's part of their summer tour. Quite rightly, much stamping of feet here from the audience as they welcome Blomstedt back onto the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, that is it for tonight's concert. Certainly tomorrow night, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales back at the Proms. Programme from them of French music, Rameau, Canteloube, a UK premiere from Martin Matelon, and Henry Wood's arrangement of Mussorgsky's Pictures in an Exhibition. I'll be over on BBC 4 television for that. The concert's also broadcast live, as always, here on BBC Radio 3. But for now, from all of us here at the Royal Albert Hall, it's time to hand you back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom broadcast again here on BBC Radio 3 on Thursday afternoon, the 16th of September at 2 o'clock. That's a fortnight tomorrow. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, in 10 minutes' time, David Wallace explores the life and work of humanist scholar John Leyland, who was commissioned by Henry VIII to search through the ancient libraries of all the religious houses of his kingdom and catalogue their literary treasures. This was before the monasteries were destroyed and their manuscripts dispersed. Leyland's Travels is at 10 o'clock. Until then, with plenty of French music in tomorrow night's first prom to contrast with the Austro-German fair of the last two nights, some French music now. A caprice on Danish and Russian airs by Saint-Saëns. It's from 1887. He'd just agreed to conduct some concerts in Russia in the company of a flautist, an oboist and a clarinetist. And he wrote this caprice to show off his skills as a pianist alongside theirs. The players here, Catherine Quentin, flute, Maurice Bourg, oboe, Michel Portal, clarinet, and the pianist is Pascal Roger. the Caprice on Danish and Russian airs by Saint-Saëns. The players there, Catherine Quentin, flute, Maurice Bourque, oboe, Michel Portal, clarinet, and the pianist was Pascal Roger. And as Susie Klein was saying earlier on, plenty more French music in tomorrow night's first prom, including a suite from Rameau's Dardanus and a selection of Cantaloube's lush and much-loved arrangements of songs from the Auvergne. 7 o'clock start for that first of tomorrow night's proms at the Royal Albert Hall and here on BBC Radio 3. Coming up to 3 minutes past ten, well, now on Radio 3 in Leyland's Travels, Professor David Wallace charts the career and travels of one of King Henry's most dedicated yet divided servants, the scholar and topographer John Leyland.
To my sovereign liege, King Henry VIII. Where as it pleased your highness, upon very just consideration to encourage me, by the authority of your most gracious commission, in the 35th year of your prosperous reign, to peruse and diligently to search all the libraries of monasteries and colleges of this your noble realm, to the intent that the monuments of ancient writers might be brought out of deadly darkness to lively light.
The antiquarian scholar John Leyland here addresses his liege lord, King Henry VIII, in 1546. For 13 years, he reminds his monarch, he has travelled tirelessly for the king, rooting out ancient texts from monastic libraries the length and breadth of the land in his first phase of travelling, and mentally mapping every inch of Henry's Empire of England and of Wales in the second. Now, as a New Year's gift, he promises to write up everything seen and learned on his laborious journey, including a four-volume history of British writers and an exhaustive description of Henry's kingdom, a book for every shire. But by 1547, before any of this could be realised, John Leyland was insane. Henry was dead, and the monasteries were gone. For me, Leyland's terminal case of writer's block is the most poignant in all English history. Never has a man travelled so far, taking so many notes, to produce so little. To travel with John Leyland is to witness unparalleled changes in English culture and English landscape as medieval Catholicism yields to the power of a centralised Tudor state. But what does it mean to help destroy the thing you love, to pose as an agent of revolutionary history while yet dreading or doubting its revolutionary effects? Leyland had honed his New Age literary skills, the perfect training for a Henrician new man, on the banks of the Thames at St. Paul's School.
John Collett, who was the Dean of St. Paul's at the time, conceived a refoundation not just as a practical matter, but with a really strong idea of a kind of education that he wanted to put forward.
The early modern scholar, Brian Cummings, speaking at Leyland's alma mater.
It was said that only four men could speak or read and write Greek in England in 1500, which is just before the school was founded. But certainly Collett sets up, even in the statutes, that he wants the teaching of Greek as well as Latin literature.
So the idea of a revolutionary break with the past is there in Leyland's education?
It's there in Leyland's education. The whole aim of the school turned from the production of potential priests and ministers to the production of people who can work in government.
One of Leyland's St. Paul's contemporaries became Lord Chancellor and died Earl of Southampton. Thomas Wriothesley, the kind of state servant that Henry liked, turned his hand to everything: diplomacy, versifying, torture. Leyland followed humanism's gentler path to preferment. In 1533, he pleased Henry mightily by penning verses in very public praise of Anne Boleyn.
He and Nicholas Udall were employed to write Latin verses and to design pageants for a quite elaborate welcome of the new queen, as she was, into London as part of her coronation. There's a surviving drawing by Holbein for the scene of Parnassus, which is one of the bits that Leyland wrote, which is described in Hall's Chronicle rather wonderfully. For there was the Mount Parnassus with the fountain of Helicon, which was of white marble, and four streams without pipe did rise an ell high, and met together in a little cup above the fountain, which fountain ran abundantly, racked Rhenish wine till night. But there's another passage where it's both white and red is on stream in the fountains.
And do we have these verses?
We have the verses that Leyland wrote, yes. This is a 19th century English translation of Leyland's Latin verse. Many had told me that Paris saw fairest forms and all beauty, that is, when tending his flocks on Ida's side. He was for giving with impartial hand the golden apple to golden Venus, to the wrath of Minerva and of Jove's sister, until fair Anna joined the company. He's making a nice connection there between Anne and the Greek goddesses of the Trojan myth. There's certainly a coincidence, which surely must be almost a kind of line of causation, between doing this work and then getting this commission to go around the libraries.
In Tudor politics, flattery gets you everywhere. It certainly propelled Leyland into his first royally funded set of travels. This early stage of travelling casts him as reference librarian. He lists works for future consultation and seeks texts that might help the king in his great matter of defying Rome and unpicking his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, his first queen. His lifelong devotion to King Arthur, the English monarch who defied and conquered Rome, inevitably drew him to Glastonbury and Wells.
When I was at Glastonbury in Somerset a few years ago, I made a short detour to Wells, hoping I might discover something of remote antiquity.
We're entering Wells Cathedral Library, which is an extraordinarily long space, James Carley.
Yes, one of the longest libraries, I think certainly intact, and I think probably one of the very few libraries that looks almost the way it would have been John Leyland was here in 1533.
So the library had been magnificently furnished with no small number of books by the bishops and canons of that city in former times. Thomas Bubwith made the east part of the cloister, with the little chapel beneath and the great library over it, having 25 windows on each side of it.
It gives you a very good sense of what kind of library would have been used in the period and the kind of intellectual life the Vicar's Quarrel would have had.
James Carley, the world's leading authority on Leyland, or to North Americans, Leland, has spent a scholarly lifetime pondering Leyland's travels, writings, and motivations.
He's here partly because he's an antiquary. He wants to find early books. He wants to find books by British authors because he's writing basically a proto-dictionary of national biography. But that's not what his, as it were, his masters, his employers wanted him to do. He was sent here precisely because his patrons, Thomas Cromwell and the Duke of Norfolk, were concerned about the huge fallout there was going to be from this marriage, which was going to lead to Henry's excommunication. They were putting together the documents that would come out in 1534, the Act of Supremacy, making Henry VIII the supreme head of the church under God in England. And John Leland's job was to find texts that would help in this mission.
The books that weren't marked, we don't have anymore. And so what's going on is a very deliberate process of selection, and Leland was clearly playing an important role in that.
The literary historian Jennifer Summit has traced the journeys of some of the texts that Leyland marked up and spirited away from monasteries to Henry's newly formed Royal Library.
So that when we go into the British Library, we're seeing the fruits of labors that began with Leyland, which is selecting books from the monasteries, bringing them into the royal collection, and then centralizing them into one national collection.
And anybody who walks into the British Library sees that awe-inspiring glass column with those beautiful ancient books at the center of the library.
That's right, and which is a striking image of books as a centerpiece of a kind of national identity. And we could say that that's what started with Leyland.
Officially, Leyland was searching for books that might please his political masters, but he also dallied with texts that might disturb hardline evangelical reformers, the Tudor heirs of John Wycliffe.
This library, from his point of view as a theologian, was a very interesting library because there were very many books written by people who were anti-Wycliffeite. And if you look at Leland's list of books, most of them are books about the Eucharist. And he is concerned about the Eucharist because Leland is a conservative, unlike his master Thomas Cromwell, and Leland is very concerned about the real presence and terrified of what he sees as a new Wycliffeite threat.
So Leland is a traditional Catholic who believes in the real presence, the actual physical presence of God in the Eucharist.
Yes, and he believed that till the end of his life. A great deal of what has been written about Leland talks about him as a Protestant. He wrote an anti-papal text in 1539, which he had to do. He wrote that when, again, England really had been excommunicated. But you can be anti-pope while still being a good Catholic. I believe that Leland always believed that England would eventually return to Catholicism. And up to 1536, there is no absolute surety that the monasteries are going to fall. When he's coming around to these places, he has no idea that this is the end.
It seems that when the end did come, Leland had trouble accepting it. His late Latin poem called Swan Song, Signia Cantio, describes ruined monasteries along the Thames as if they were still up and running. In the early days of his visits to religious houses, when he arrived to make his exhaustive inventories, Leland, armed with his royal warrant, was often warmly received by monks who were fellow bibliophiles. Glastonbury, the richest monastery in England, seemed fit to endure for 1,000 years.
A few years ago, I was at Glastonbury in Somerset, where the most ancient and at the same time most famous abbey in our whole island is located. By the favour of Richard Whiting, abbot of that place, I had intended to refresh my spirits, wearied by the long effort of my studies, when a burning desire to read and learn inflamed me afresh. This desire, moreover, came upon me more quickly than I thought it would, so I immediately went to the library, which is not open to all, in order to examine most diligently all the relics of most sacred antiquity, of which there is so great a number that it is not easily paralleled anywhere else in Britain. Scarcely had I crossed the threshold when the mere sight of the ancient book struck my mind with an awe or stupor of some kind. Then, having saluted the genius loci, I spent some days searching through all the bookcases with the greatest curiosity.
This is maybe our very last view of a person looking at a monastic library. This is 1533. It's 6 years before the monastery is completely destroyed. He stayed with the abbot, who he describes in the first version of that text as, he said, a real gentleman and my greatest friend. And this would have been a rest stop. He would have been well fed, his horse well watered, but obviously the library is so exciting to him that that's where he went.
Glastonbury is clearly the telos of this first journey, isn't it? It's the place of destination for him.
In a sense, Glastonbury was the key position because he had come during the period when we were leading to the Act of Supremacy, where ancient histories are cited. And as he says right there, this is the place where you would find the material.
And we're looking out from Richard Whiting's abbot's house through the ruined entranceway of his dwelling. And in the distance, we can see Glastonbury Tor.
It is particularly poignant. This doorway, where he looks up to his great church on the Tor, St. Michael's, is where, 6 years later, he would found himself hanged, surrounded by two junior monks on either side of him, a trinity on the top of a hill. It is especially sad because this was a very old man, a gentleman by all accounts, and a good man. He did not deserve the fate that came to him. It was very hard to find anything irregular about the life at Glastonbury. When they wanted finally to arrest him, and it was determined that this monastery would go, all they could find was, as they said, a counterfeit Life of Becket in print and some papal bulls. That's all they could find. It was almost impossible to catch this man.
But he would have died looking down on the abbey as he knew it.
He would have died looking down on the abbey as he knew it.
Leyland later scratched from his notebook heartfelt references to Abbot Whiting as a truly splendid man and an especial friend. Such prudent erasures and careful marking up of texts continued throughout Leyland's career. At that time, choices of texts and phrases could prove, as Richard Whiting discovered, matters of life and death. Leyland was careful to delete the prefix Sanctus from his own catalogue references to Thomas Becket. As time went by, Leyland must have seemed like an angel of death or harbinger of ruin when arriving at monastery gates. Leyland catalogued marvellous holdings which were then dispersed, the monasteries dissolved. The great abbey of Bury St Edmunds, when first encountered early in his travels, boasted the finest library in the land, some 2,000 books, a vast collection at that time. Bury dazzled like a new Jerusalem.
The sun does not shine on a more beautifully situated town, on a monastery more famed for its endowments, size and splendour. There are so many gates, some of brass, so many towers, and a church unsurpassed by any other, that it makes you think you are looking on a city.
Just a few years later, less benign commissioners of the king found their way to Bury. Their search for riches was literal, not literary. They left Bury as a series of extraordinary ruins that seemed more like the product of some natural disaster.
What's for certain is that he would have wept were he to see what we see before us now.
James Simpson, Professor of Medieval Literature at Harvard.
We see columns of stone beaten as if by the sea, but only after looking at them for a little while do we understand and see that they are in fact humanly crafted columns. They're clearly the fillers for what had been the main pillars of a great abbey church. The destruction of Bury happened with remarkable rapidity. We have letters by people commissioned to destroy the abbeys sent to Cromwell, who administered the Court of Augmentations. One letter sent in 1538 says that, "Have been at St. Edmund's Bury, where we found a rich shrine, very cumbrous to deface. Having taken in the monastery over 5,000 marks in gold and silver, besides a rich cross with emeralds and stones of great value. Today we depart towards Ely."
The destruction is a complicated business, isn't it? It takes a lot of effort and organisation.
Destroying buildings of this size was no easy business. But one thing we can be sure of is that the fate of books was of little consequence when so much material goods were to be gained in this massive transfer of land and property, the largest such transfer of land in England since the Norman Conquest. The Protestant bibliographer John Bale lamented in 1549 about the terrible destruction and loss of monastic library holdings. Bale was no friend to monasteries, but he was certainly a great friend to their books, and he complains that many of the new owners of the monasteries, that's to say people in the Tudor ascendancy, reserved of those library books some to serve their jakes, that's to say their toilets, some to scour their candlesticks, and some to rub their boots. Some they sold to the gracers and the soap sellers, and some they sent over the sea to the bookbinders, not in small number, to the wondering of the foreign nations.
So medieval manuscripts just become a source of spare leather, if you like.
Spare leather, some to scour their candlesticks and some to rub their boots. I imagine that medieval manuscripts may have been used to wrap fish in.
Such events must have anguished Leyland. The gentle bookworm becomes harbinger of vandals, iconoclasts, and destroyers of texts. But spoliation was always latent in Leyland's commission. The king and Thomas Cromwell wanted to know what the monasteries had and what could be had from them. Leyland's book listing was clearly not entirely innocent, and as early as 1534, before the full force of dissolution destructiveness was unleashed, we find him precociously involved in an act of iconoclasm. This is reported in a letter to Thomas Cromwell.
As Master Leyland and I did walk in the Cathedral Church of York, he perceived a table hanging upon the wall within the said church, and there found represented the reign of divers kings of this realm, among which he found one line of a king that took the kingdom of the Pope by tribute to hold of the Church of Rome, which I cut out of the said table and raised the same, and herein I send you the title thereof as it was in the said table. Your servant, George Lawson.
This table no longer hangs in York Minster, but may still be found in a dark corner of the Minster Library.
So, well, that's like a diptych, isn't it, with parchment in the middle?
It is, actually. It is, that's right. It's like opening up a sort of piece of history in front of your eyes.
I gazed upon this astonishing relic of fractious times with its iconoclastic slash in the parchment in the company of historian Bill Shields.
And look, you can see it here, that gap on the third column of this kind of four-column parchment account backed onto that wooden frame, which must have been quite a staggering piece of, as it were, iconoclasm in front of the Minster clergy at this febrile time in British politics for an outsider, a royal man from Berwick, plus a royal official, if you like, from London coming up and taking apart one of their treasured documents. They took that piece out because classically, in the controversy over papal power, the reign of King John was one of those central sort of features, as was, I suppose, Becket as well. But the papacy had placed England under an interdict during John's reign, and John had to show obedience to the Pope to remove that papal interdict. So it was a classic case of English royal power accepting that it emanated from papal imperial authority. So that's why it was so important at this time.
And you can really read the future from that great slash, can't you? Today the document, tomorrow the monasteries. So this does align Leyland the book lover with more aggressive commissioners.
I think it does, actually. They are executors of royal policy, as well as, in Leyland's case, a disinterested scholarly searcher out.
Resistance to Henry's commissioners was especially strong in Yorkshire, where a full-scale rising was led by a local lawyer, Robert Aske. This pilgrimage of grace saw some 20,000 rebels march on York in October 1536. Thousands of them processed singing down the aisle at York Minster, carrying banners of Christ crucified and wearing pilgrim badges.
Christ crucified, Christ crucified, for thy wounds why thus columns guide, which pilgrims me.
Leyland's bookish travels suddenly seem more difficult to distinguish.